Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome everyone to Be Above Leadership's Blog Talk Radio Show. I am Ursula Pottinger and I'm here with my good buddy and co-founder of Be Above Leadership, Anne Betts. And today we are going to have a wonderful conversation with Elaine, and the topic is Exploring Challenges, Providing Hope, Neurodiversity with our wonderful expert, Elaine. And I'm going to have Anne introduce Elaine. So welcome.
Well, we'll do a bit of a brief introduction because I know everybody is probably just waiting to hear from her. But Elaine Taylor-Klaus is just my go-to in this area. She's been working in the area of all things, in her words, neurospicy for probably over 15 years. And she's an author and a coach. She has great advice for coaches. We're going to post a resource that she's providing. We'll have that in the links when this goes live. She is just full of great ideas, and I want to just jump right into it. So, Elaine, really welcome to Be Above Leadership Blog Talk.
Thank you. I am truly delighted and honored to be here.
Well, we are excited for this conversation because this whole topic is really hot and heating up and getting a lot of attention and having a lot of questions. So my first question for you is, neurodiversity is a pretty big umbrella term. And so, you know, if we're going to talk about it, what, you know, in your words, what do you feel like that means?
So if you look at it in that broad sense, neurodiversity is the notion that people's brains are wired differently and that everybody's brain functions differently. I mean, it really is as simple as that. So if you look at the spectrum of human brains, there is a neurodiversity to all the different ways that we are wired and think and process information. Mm-hmm. And I think often the term is used when they really are often talking about neurodivergence. That's what I like to call neurospicy. When the brain deviates from what is a, quote, typical brain. But across the board, neurodiversity just means we all think and process information differently.
Oh, I love that because it sort of brings me to this point, like, is there a typical brain? Is there, you know, and it's a word, it's a term I've stopped actually using. I've stopped saying neurotypical because it feels like, you know, that's otherizing people.
Correct. Yeah. Well, go ahead, Ursula.
Go ahead, Elaine. No, go ahead, Elaine.
I just think within the realm of neurodiversity, what happens is when there is something that can become an impediment to someone's success, to how they process information, that's when we begin to look at it as a neurodivergence. And I shied away from that term for over a decade because I felt exactly what you're saying, that it was pejorative, that it other, that it was, that had a negative connotation. But now, because neurodiversity has become such a hot topic and kind of a buzzword, I think it's really important to identify the way in which neurodivergence or neurospiciness can be both a challenge and an opportunity, and not just, not just a difference.
So I don't also find that.
I've got a comment here, Elaine,
yeah,
sort of out of my own realm, my own world.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just a tendency when we talk about neurodiversity, people throw in ADD and ADHD as if that is the be-all and end-all of what is going on, without realizing that there's a lot more to it.
Correct. Well, and some, you'll either see it summarized as ADHD, or you'll see it summarized as autism very frequently as well. And it's interesting, when I started my company in 2011, it was originally called Impact ADHD, because what my business partner and I had in common was children with ADHD. There were other issues, but that was what we had in common. And what we became clear about pretty quickly was that it was never just about ADHD. And that they was almost always this kind of co-occurring blend of conditions, this kind of human soup that is our fascinating brains. And so we actually rebranded and expanded to impact parents because we wanted to reflect the full range of issues that families were dealing with, that ADHD or autism or anxiety or depression or trauma or, you know, any of these single things all blended together very more often than not.
And, you know, it's interesting. So we've been, Ursula and I have been doing some exploring in this area. And what's so interesting is that sometimes it can be hard to tell, or you can have co-occurring. You know, trauma can create some of the same adaptations in the brain that autism spectrum or ADHD might create in the brain, or anxiety. And the I like the idea of the I'm picturing kind of a very complex Venn diagram right now in my brain of where everything, you know, potentially could intersect with a person.
Well, and that is why I started using the term, I don't know, over 10 years ago, complex kids. You know, so I'm working predominantly with parents and professionals who support them. And I just, the labels, while I think they're very important for treatment, they're not often very important for self-empowerment and self-management. And so when you begin to shift it from your kid is defined as, you know, diagnosis, ADHD, autism, depression, whatever, and you begin to say, this is a complex kid. How do we want to come together to support this complex kid with this amazing and yet complex brain? I think it takes, again, that negative connotation away and allows us to meet the kid where they are and meet the parents where they are.
Oh, my gosh. I love that, because the word complexity, if I think about where my brain goes with that, is I think about challenges, but I also, that it just has this embrace of gifts as well.
Yes.
So,
exactly.
And I know we want to get to the gifts. Ursula, you had kind of a pressing question on your mind, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, Anne and I, you know, work in the coaching space. So one of my biggest curiosities is why do coaches need to understand the complexity? And, you know, how do I know what's going on, and how can I help and support, you know, clients that I might be working with? You know, why do coaches need to understand this topic?
Ooh, yeah. So there are a million answers to that question, and it's a phenomenal question, so thank you. And let me segue for a second to tell you what we do at Impacts is we teach coaching skills to parents. Because when we became coaches, we became significantly better parents to our complex kids, and we realized it wasn't rocket science. That when you hold an empowering framework, when you see possibility and opportunity instead of deficit, when you remove judgment and you create vision and take a strength-based approach, and when you see that nothing is broken that needs to be fixed, all of those, the fundamental empowerment nature of coaching is inherently useful, effective, and profoundly transformational for people with neurodivergence. So when a coach can blend in a neurodiversity-informed framework, it enhances their already kind of default go-to as coaches. Like, this is how we want to meet our clients, right? Mm-hmm. We want to see them as whole and not broken and hold them possible. And we invite them to see themselves as creative, resourceful, and whole, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a really powerful modality, because what happens is when coaches don't understand the underlying neurodiversity, it can actually challenge their capacity as a coach to meet their clients where they are and to bring all of these values that they want to bring to the coaching, because they're getting met with obstacles they don't expect. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so you're saying what I'm really hearing, which I love, is coaches are trained to have the right come from place, the being place.
Absolutely.
Right? Like,
yeah.
And then what I'm curious about, and I'm sure there's a million different answers to this question, Elaine, is so we're locked in with good on the being. What about the doing? What is different
exactly
if a coach is – maybe suspecting that their client is, we'll even take the two big buckets, either autism spectrum or ADHD. And then, sorry, I don't mean to make this too complicated, but immediately I think of, and then there are those clients who are, you know they are, and then there are those clients who don't know they are.
Beautiful. Yes. That important is so, that distinction is so important. So starting with, on some level, it doesn't matter whether they know they're diagnosed or not, right?
Okay.
What matters is that we understand that people process information differently and come from different frameworks. So when a coach doesn't understand neurodiversity, they can mistakenly interpret their client's behaviors or indecision or lack of follow-through. I was teaching a group of coaches a couple of years ago, and this one very successful executive coach who works mostly in the corporate environment said to me, "Oh, my God, those clients that I thought were just a pain in the neck. Oh, my God, they all had neurodivergence, didn't they?" You know, and so there's that tendency to interpret their behavior as willful, right? They're just not motivated because they didn't follow through with their homework. They don't really care. They're not really committed because they're showing up late to their sessions. There are assumptions that we coaches can make about a client's behavior if we don't understand that there's a fundamental executive function challenge underneath it that's making it difficult for them to show up on time for a session or to calendarize effectively or, you know, fill in the blank. So I think that's one
do their homework.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting, Elaine. I have an example from just this morning. You know, I had a client scheduled, and I do know that this client is somewhat distracted, as I would call it, and she didn't show up for our call. She didn't answer my email saying, you know, I'm waiting for you. I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, call me. And I agree with you. It has really, really helped me both in terms of neurospicy as well as trauma is to give my clients a lot more leeway. And I can really see how this is also helpful for parents because I think parents are even more inclined to sort of pass a judgment. And again, very quickly, an example from yesterday, our 9-year-old granddaughter plays basketball, and in this very noisy, completely overwhelming whistling, too many kids going at the basketball all at once, she had this glazed look in her eyes, and my daughter kept saying, I mean, look at her, look at her, why can't she focus? Why, look at her. Why can't she do it? What is she doing? And I mean, my poor heart went out, and I thought, well, the reason why she's not functioning right now is that she's completely overwhelmed by the stimulation.
So the language you use that's so important, and this is what we tell parents, but also coaches, is when you hear yourself saying or thinking, why can't they just? Why can't they just is code for there's something going on that's leading to that behavior. And it's a powerful tool. And so if we have a limiting belief that they need to just, then we're going to hold them differently than if we can meet that by saying, wow, that's a symptom. What's going on underneath that behavior? How can I support this challenge instead of, because as coaches, I think we're often trained, we're not supposed to chase them. We're going to let them come to us, right?
Yes.
Well, if they're nerds, if they're neurospicy, that may not be a fair expectation on them.
Yeah.
So for example, I have a client I work with who is a, you know, high-end New York City physician, very successful in her professional career. And we have an arrangement that when it's time for our session, I text her the link. Even though it's the same link every time, it's the same time, every week, I text her the link.
Oh.
And that is an easy accommodation for me to make for her to take advantage of the time that she commits to, but then she gets distracted, you know?
Yes.
You know, Elaine, I'm so appreciative that you're saying this because, you know, as you were talking about, you know, expectations of our clients, you know, I was sitting here with, you know, I've been a coach for over 20 years, and I'm sitting here thinking, raising my hand for this, raising my hand for why can't they just, you know, I'm going to out myself here. And what I love that you brought in is not for me to, you know, deflect responsibility, but this did come back to how I was trained at my coaching school. They need to be 100% in. They need to show up. If they don't show up, you know, you should call them forth, rather than saying, do they need, what kind of, with every client maybe, what kind of support do they need? What what's different for this person? So that's already just a big takeaway for me. And it may not mean what I was told it meant, that they don't care about coaching.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so when we do training for coaches, can I just respond to that really quickly?
Yeah.
Because one of the things we do when we train coaches in neurodivergence and neurodiversity is to say, what needs to change in your practice? How do you want to adapt your practice to meet your clients? And one of the adaptations is to ask them up front, how do you prefer to receive information? Do you prefer text? Do you prefer email? What do you need in terms of reminders? Like, to design with them from the outset what will help set them up for success in the coaching, instead of assuming that they should comply with our coaching practices and procedures that were set up for our convenience, but not necessarily for theirs. I mean, that's a simple little thing, but it can have a profound shift in coaching.
And there was one word that you said that really, really landed for me, and you were saying, it's not fair to expect that. And, you know, if it's not fair, then how can we make it more fair, more equal, given that certain things are not, might not be working for them?
In a school environment, we argue for accommodations for our kids to level the playing field. And as coaches, we want to be open to the possibility that, that our clients may need some accommodations that will set them up for the greatest success in the coaching engagement.
That is lovely. And I'm really hoping that there are some coach trainers who are listening to this today, because I think this is one small thing that could change in coach training, in saying rather than there being absolutes about the way you should do it, we need to be more aware of the, you know, huge diversity of our people that we're working with.
Myth-busting. There's a lot of myth-busting. I think that's a great language for it, because we all function on our assumptions, and that's, you know, it's reasonable until they're challenged to go with what we know. But, you know, we don't recognize the very subtle, nuanced ways as coaches in which we shift our way of being in ways that may not be supportive of our client. We may be shifting into more of a consultant role to accommodate their challenges, instead of acknowledging and helping them see what their challenges and learn to navigate them themselves. Like, they're very subtle ways in which I think we do this.
Any other favorite myth-busting things that come to mind, as long as we're here for a moment?
So I think that there is a lot of what happens in neurospicy brains is that there's a difference in the way we process information. And I think a lot of us got that foundational education of, are you auditory, are you verbal, are you visual, right? But we're going to a next level, which has to do with sequencing and prioritizing and creativity. And so, you know, sometimes I think coaches may unintentionally direct their clients' processing of information or their approach to problem solving to meet the way that they approach problem solving, which may be very different from the way that their client's natural tendency or sweet spot is in terms of problem solving, right? Some people need to get it all out and then figure it out and find the Venn diagram, and some people need word clouds, and some people need, you know, everybody processes differently. I remember, and this is a true story, when I was in coach training, just going back, you know, a million years, and we were in a class on balance coaching at CTI, and they started talking about this particular method for problem solving for, it was a planning exercise. I fell into tears. I mean, literally was like, and left the room hysterical because I thought, if this is what's required of me, I can't do this because that's just not how my brain processes information. And, you know, that was my own gremlins, and I learned to navigate my gremlins. But I do think it's indicative of this larger, the notion that here is a way that people can problem solve, so therefore everybody can problem solve this way. I mean, that's anathema to coaching in the first place. But we kind of do that anyway.
No, you're making, I went to this time that I was trying to learn Spanish, and my ex-husband and my Spanish teacher were busy dissecting the parts of speech and having a wonderful time. Yes, you're laughing because I think you and I would have been running out of the room in tears as well. And I was so frustrated and angry and in tears because I could not learn that way. I absolutely couldn't. And they were looking at me like I was stupid, and I'm not stupid. I just do not process that way. So you're,
There was actually a book written many years ago by Kay Kelly and Peggy Raimondo, a long time ago, that was called You Mean I'm Not Lazy, Stupid, or Crazy? Specifically a book about adult ADD. But it really, there are so many times in my life before I was diagnosed and since, frankly, where I felt, well, I felt stupid. And then I really felt stupid most of my life. And I felt like I was fooling everybody that, that somehow they didn't realize that I was really dumb, even though they kept telling me I was smart. I had a lot of executive challenges with working memory, for example. I have some learning disabilities, so I hear sounds differently, so I can remember the syllables, but I can't remember the word. Or, I mean, there are several different ways in which, not understanding it, it was really easy to jump to the conclusion myself that I must be stupid and they just don't know.
Well, and I think, you know, that makes so much sense. I just have to jump in for a minute because we also don't have enough information about other people, so we assume everyone else can do this perfectly, and that, you know, there must be, so I, you know, one of the things I figured out, luckily figured out for myself, that I can't understand something the first time I read it, but I can understand it the second time I read it. I think of it as a weaving. Like the first time I'm just laying down the threads in one direction, it makes no sense. But if I read this twice, I can. And, I think the more we share, the more stories there are, the more people start realizing this is just a different way of processing. It's not that 99% of the people in the world take in everything that they read. I don't think they probably don't, but it feels like that. And I think especially the younger people who with less experience, it's got to just feel like I'm the one who's wrong. And it occurs to me that
I love that example.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Real quick, I love that example.
Go,
because even if you've heard it twice, now you understand it. That still doesn't mean you're going to remember it.
Yes, right. No, I don't remember anything unless I teach it more than three times. But if I teach it once, forget it. But three times, maybe then I'm probably. That's why Ursula and I started teaching neuroscience. It was way too cool to forget.
Exactly.
People are like, you're so smart. You're like, you have no freaking idea. We just talk about this all day long every day. You know, it makes us seem really smart, but it's just because no way am I going to remember it the first time.
No, absolutely. Yeah. There is no way. Now, we've been talking a lot about, you know, the challenges and, you know, that also sometimes structures and also systems like schools, for example, really don't necessarily accommodate, you know, all the various ways we process information. But what would you say, Elaine, are the gifts? Like, what's the upside of being neurospicy?
Oh, wow, there's so many gifts. And when we can give people the opportunity to find their gifts, it's amazing what they can do. When we in the ADD coaching realm, they like to say, play to your strengths and outsource your challenges, right? So
and
when you look
what
at the
second, what's the second part? Play to your strengths.
Outsource.
Yes.
right? When I was diagnosed with ADHD, the very first thing I did was hire a bookkeeper. Like, okay,
yeah.
I'm done spending, you know, all that time. So some of the gifts, so giftedness actually is very, very common in the realm of neurospicy people. Outside the box thinking, excitability, sometimes there's a high energy. Sometimes that can be a challenge, but sometimes it can be a real gift. Empathy, you often see a more enhanced empathy. You're talking about a population of people who very often overcome a great deal of obstacles in their path.
Mm.
So there's a capacity to be present to other people's experience and feeling. There's some research and a lot of discussion about, is there heightened creativity in this population or not? Probably yes, but I don't think it's been documented as clearly as it needs to be yet. Again, kind of what I was saying a minute ago, there's a lot of resilience. Mm-hmm. And when you look at adults, look in the field of coaching, what are all of our colleagues doing? They're playing to their challenges. They're making their mess their message. They're identifying the ways in which they've overcome something difficult to step into a space where they can support and serve others. And that's resilience incarnate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of innovation and vision and, yeah.
I love this and I want you to go on. I just wanted to pull something out, which is, you know, and Ursula and I work a lot with newer coaches, with people who are building, you know, training businesses, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's hard, that can be hard when you go sort of outside in, is staying motivated. You know, come up with a great idea. Oh, I should do this because this is the time that, you know, this is going to be strategic. And I have never found the strategic answer to remain motivating, but I have found the make your mess your message to be very consistently motivating. And that's a big thing for, you know, solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, to not lose sight of what they care about. So I just wanted to, that's a huge, huge value.
So one of the things, so we have this kind of 1-hour-ish, 1.5-hour class that we teach on what do coaches need to know about neurodiversity. And one of the things we teach in it is 5 contexts for coaches to really better understand it and support it, and motivation is one of the 5. Mm-hmm. Because if you really don't, understanding that motivation is not always intrinsic, motivation and intention is not always enough. If you've got, for example, an executive function challenge, you can be as motivated and have the intention, and that doesn't prevent you necessarily from getting distracted or derailed or emotionally hijacked or whatever it is. So understanding what motivates you can be a really powerful tool to activate. And a lot of where our challenges with our clients fall in is their capacity to activate on what's important to them, and they may need another motivator besides it's important to me. I have a great story. Can I tell a quick story?
Yeah,
about it?
Please. I'd love to hear an example of that. That's cool.
So we teach a framework. It's called PENCH, and it's about, you know, the different ways that people can motivate themselves when they have neurospicy brains. And the first one is P, stands for play, creativity, humor, all kind of fall in that realm. We were having a family event. We had actually had a death in the family, and I had 3 teenagers. My oldest was 18, and I needed them to leave the house and go to the grocery store while we talked to the rabbi and handled some stuff. And I knew that they didn't want to go any more than I wanted them to have to, but I really needed them to. So I looked at the oldest, and I said, you know, I kind of enrolled them, and this would be really helpful. What do you think would help make it possible for you all to go? And they looked at me, and they looked at their siblings, and looked at me, and they looked back at their siblings, and they said, okay, everybody, superheroes to the grocery store. And they donned capes and tights and shorts and made it to the grocery store.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh,
and
my
God. And it was hysterical. But that's what they needed to motivate. They had to find the play in it to motivate themselves to do something that in that moment was really hard for them to do because they just lost their grandfather, right?
Oh, my God. I'm the visual of that. And I think about, Elaine, you're making me think of, I recently was talking to a wonderful new coach, and she was taking one of those ridiculously, excuse my judgment, expensive programs that's going to guarantee you the six-figure income. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And at one point, you know, it just is almost like I could see the weight on her shoulders. And I said, looked at her and said, "Are you having any fun?" And she sort of like gave me that deer in the headlights look. And I said, "Has anybody asked you what the fun way to do this is?" Because she's doing the website and doing the thing and all the stuff you're supposed to do.
The slog.
And, oh, my gosh. And I think about, you know, the reason I say that is I think I have no idea if she's neurodivergent or not, because she was sucking it up, baby, doing her thing, but, you know, not having any fun. And I think what we can learn here, I want to do superheroes to the grocery store. What, you know, like, I'm ready. You know, what can we learn that is actually applicable to all of us? And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more, that if we can begin to identify what does motivate us and what doesn't motivate us. Some of us are motivated by putting a check mark, and there are those out there who are going to write it on their list so they can check it off. Booyah for them, right? That is not going to get me to get my house cleaned or my laundry done, or, like, it's just not going to work for me. But figuring out what's important, and what either the acronym we use is PINCH, so play is the first one, interest, novelty, the C is connection or competition or collaboration. It can be a lot of things related to others. And then H is hurry up. That's urgency. That's a lot of people with neurodivergence, I think, rely on what I call the amygdala hijack, rely on urgency
panic
to get stuff done. We wait to the last minute. We get judged like crazy for doing it. But there's a reason we do it. We do it because it's a different part of our brain, as you well know, kicking in, and we're waiting for the amygdala to get some hormones firing to get us activated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a terrible strategy. You just don't want that to be your only mechanism to getting yourself motivated, because then you end up in a constant stress cycle and a cortisol.
You end up with all sorts of other impacts, but it, you know, everything that you're saying is so beautifully aligned with different aspects of the brain. Of course it is, but, you know, and I'm sure Ursula's sitting here with her, you know, just like me going, yep, everything you're saying is aligned with the research on neuroplasticity, you know, connection, relationship. We teach this in our program, humor, play, novelty, all of those in any brain create more neural firing, create, you know, stronger neural pathways. And then the piece about, we talk a lot about the Goldilocks of the brain and finding the sweet spot of stimulation where you're not understimulated. And we do know in a lot of ADHD brains, not all, but what you have is sort of an endemic lack of dopamine, norepinephrine. It may not have the same resting state, right, as other brains. And so finding this place of saying, where is my optimal function where I'm not panicked, but I'm stimulated, and I've got more neural, you know, I've got the right amount of neurotransmitters that are making me the smartest. And this is something Ursula and I use with all of our clients. And Ursula, I don't know if you want to add anything about that.
Yeah, no, the only thing that I want to add is, as I hear Elaine talk about, you know, neurodivergent clients and humans, I really see that it really exists on a continuum, because many of the things that you're talking about also apply to me. You know, and I am sort of whatever typical is, you know, that's my brain. But, you know, if I can't play or have fun in it, I feel just so unmotivated. This was one of the things that just, again, occurred this morning. I'm sort of dragging myself from A to B, and then I looked at the calendar and I thought, but I get to talk to Anne and Elaine. Oh, this is going to be so fun. And, I mean, my energy just shifted. And it's like, You know, mm-hmm. so what's, you know, I, you know, certainly consider myself, you know, somewhat typical, although the more I hear you talk, the more I have my doubts.
The more we're wondering about all of that, right?
You know, I'm honestly, I am beginning to wonder what's happening with me, but it really applies to all humans. It's just
yes.
to the degree, you know, it's a continuum. One of some of us, you know, I need very little of this, while other people just need a lot more.
Absolutely. It does apply to all humans. And that's what we say in our realm is, you know, when the pandemic hits, like, okay, this is about parenting complex kids, and it's about parenting kids in complex times. Because it really doesn't matter whether you're neurodivergent, neurotypical, where you fall on that spectrum. You spoke to it so beautifully, because absolutely there is a spectrum. What matters, I think, is when it becomes a deficit, a divergence,
yeah.
a challenge, when it's interfering with your capacity to reach your
yeah.
to be your best self, to reach your whatever it is you want to achieve. And so I don't want to minimize the ways in which sometimes it really is an obstacle for people to learn to overcome.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean
yes.
it's an excuse. But that explanation helps me say, okay, I do struggle with that. And so therefore, in order to navigate it, I must find a motivation. I have to identify a motivation before I start trying
mm-hmm.
to do something. Or I really need to pay attention to when I'm regulating my nervous system and to notice when I'm starting to get irritated or triggered and to do what I need to do to downregulate and decompress before I try to problem solve. Like to
mm-hmm.
set myself up for success as a neurospicy adult, and I would say for all of us out there, but all the more important when you are dealing with neurodivergence is that
mm-hmm.
we have to understand how our brain's functioning well
yeah.
enough
yes.
to know
yes.
when this goes to the point you made very early on, which was the difference between prevention and management. Right?
Yeah.
Sometimes
and
we're
I,
looking at yeah, go.
No, there's just so much here, but because I think about that is one of the things that I love about bringing coaches into neuroscience for all of their clients is, you know,
mm-hmm.
Ursula and I say, we've been given this incredibly complex human system, the brain, the nervous system, the body, as well as the systems we find ourselves in the relationships. It's very complex, and we don't have much of a user's guide to it. And so what
right.
you're doing and what we're doing is helping people have a user's guide for their
mm-hmm.
particular brain and saying, hey, here are some, it's almost like a car. It's like, here are some general things about cars, but we all have a unique car. So let's see, how does your car, you know, how hot does your engine need to get, for example?
Mm-hmm.
And let's
yeah.
explore that so that you know, and when you're feeling a certain way, you know, do I need more stimulation? Do I need less? Is my nervous system responding to something? Do I need to go walk in nature? So that we can be empowered to have whatever, I'm using the car metaphor, you know, sort of whatever car we've got, you know, run at its maximum performance.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Ned Halliwell often talks about ADHD as being a Ferrari brain with bicycle brakes. So to play with your car analogy.
I see that. I get the visual of that, right?
And that's a particular aspect that's just speaking to the impulsivity aspect of it, right? And you could come up with a different one for the attention aspect or the, you know, self-regulation. But at the end of the day, it's all about, like, what I say to parents is that my job, and to the professionals that we support, my job is to help you understand these kids well enough, to help them understand themselves well enough,
mm-hmm.
to learn to navigate themselves in the world from a place of strength mm-hmm. and possibility and not from a place of judgment and shame. It's really that simple. And the world judges and shames the neurospicy humans that step outside of the norm. If I have to say,
yeah.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? I didn't process what you said. Can you say it again? A lot, for years, I think a lot of people find that embarrassing. You know, for me, I have just learned to say it without shame. It's like, I'm sorry, I missed that. Can you say it again? And, you know, I normalize the ways in which we all need to receive information.
I just love that. Yeah. No, because you're making me think of something in coaching. So one of my very, very early coaches was a CTI leader, really powerful guy. And he said to me in the very first session, he said, I have ADHD. I'm not going to take any notes. I don't take notes. And but I'm going to be totally with you. You can count on that I will be 100% with you in every session, even if I don't remember what happened in the previous one.
Totally.
Awesome coach. I have memorable breakthroughs. And it also, as a coach, gave me a little more permission that I didn't have to write everything down, that really what was needed, he showed me what was needed was his presence in that moment, not, you know, some record of everything. But I just loved that he was completely unashamed.
I cannot tell you how often I'll have a client or a parent or somebody say to me, can you say that again? And my response is, no, I'm sorry. I have no idea.
Ursula, that's you.
That's me. Yeah.
Please don't ask me to say it again because I am fully present and I don't take notes and I don't always remember. And I design that with my clients because what you want me for is to be present with you now, not to remember what you said or the story, because that goes into the story and it's not about the story. It's about the essence of what's important. Right?
I have a little bit of a, I'm not sure, I'm going to think out loud with this one, because a lot of our clients as coaches are in the workplace in some way, and they're looking for coaching to support themselves there. And how do you, if there's something around, what are the systems that best support neurospicy people is sort of part A, and part B, how do you help neurospicy people sort of sort out, like, what's a system issue and what's a you issue?
That is a beautiful question. And I'm going to call it one, not two, because I think the answer to the first question comes from the second question. So it's really about meeting them where they are, helping them understand what works for them, what doesn't, what they want to try next, and inviting that into the workplace. So, you know, like I had a client once who was really having a hard time getting thought work done. She could get her busy work done, but she couldn't get the real thought work done. And she finally went to her supervisor and asked for permission to use a conference room. It was that simple. Because she realized she needed a space to be able to get creative, and she needed the whiteboard, and she needed to spread out. And so it's not about what systems work better for neurospicy people, and I don't mean to make you wrong. I think that the question flips the other way. The question is, how do we help neurospicy people identify what does work for them, what doesn't, and what do they want to try next, and what do they want to advocate for themselves? And so the only answer I have to that question is that the solutions are in the successes, because success breeds success. So if you help them see how they've been successful in one place, then they can map it to other places.
Well, you were mentioning the pandemic, and I know, depending on the type of neurospiciness, that for some folks it was such a relief if they had high sensitivity, you know, to just be able to work in a quiet way and, you know, in the way that in their own environment. And I, you know, Ursula and I joke that at this point in our lives we're basically unemployable. I could not work in a busy office. I would not get anything done because I've got that level of sensitivity where I can't process if there's a lot going on around me.
Yeah. Well, nowadays you would bring headphones in, noise-canceling headphones, or, you know, like there are ways in which we're seeing people accommodate for themselves in all kinds of workplaces for what they need. But you have to understand yourself well enough to figure out what works for you. And that's the permission I think we really want to give people. It doesn't matter where you fall on the spectrum. It's to understand what works for you. and what doesn't work for you.
Yeah.
And ask for what you need.
And also encouraging to advocate for themselves without the judgment and the shame that many of them might feel. I had a client who was working in a very, very busy school environment, elementary school, and you know, like a whole bunch of kids in a school, the noise that can make. I mean, it was just way too stimulating for her. And our work was really around, okay, if you are authentically this person with these challenges and this does not work for you, then how can you advocate for yourself and help other people understand that this is not how you can work effectively? There's so many things getting in the way. What can be changed also in your environment that helps you be more effective?
That goes back to what do you need to be to set
what
yourself
you need,
up
yeah.
for success? What has that looked like in the past, and how can you apply that here?
Yeah.
You know, and you, there's sort of a question coming to me that for us to, you know, ask, and, you know, you said that there was a good trigger anytime you're saying, why can't they just, that's a place to look. But I'm also thinking that, you know, that the emotions could be such a great doorway. Like if I've got a client who's on edge a lot and angry a lot, that may be pointing to, and I'm thinking about my own son who has a pretty sensitive, nervous, you know, emotional field, and he just does better when he's got peace and quiet. I think he's growing out of this, but for a long time would just get really angry. And now I didn't realize that was where the anger was pointing. I just probably it's back to the why can't he just. But this for coaches to say, when you've got a client who's going through that, what is this unmet need? Let's go deeper.
The language I would offer to play with that, Anne, is that irritation happens in the gap between expectation and reality. What's really happening for someone, what expectation we think we've set for them, and when they're starting to show a behavior, and it could be angry, irritated, sad, it doesn't matter what the behavior is. Behavior is a symptom that something else is going on.
Right.
And very, very often what you'll see is that those kind of little T triggered responses are because there's some gap between what we expected of them or what they expected of themselves. Because we humans absorb the expectations of society. And so not only does my boss or my mom think I should be able to, but therefore I think I should be able to. And if I can't or I don't or I won't, then something's wrong with me. I mean, I remember my eldest child said to me at about 16, "Don't you see, Mom, if I haven't done it, I haven't done it wrong." And it was this epiphanous moment for me. It's like their expectations were so out of sync with what they felt their capacity was that it didn't really matter whether it was their capacity. And we needed to shift to meet them where they were instead of piling expectation on expectation.
I'm really rocked by that because I'm thinking about so many clients where I think that, I mean, that your daughter had, your child had the insight to say that. But I think of this as underlying so many of my clients where I may be thinking, why can't they just get out of their own way? So if someone's got this, you know, this sort of loop of, as long as I don't do it, I don't face doing it wrong. What's your best piece of advice as a coach to, you know, kind of help detangle that knot?
That's a tough one. It's a great, if you can get to that awareness, then it's an unpacking of what's underneath it. What's the mindset? What's the limiting belief? We talk about layers, right? So what's underneath it? We can give the pat answer of, oh, there's a fear of failure or failure of success, or, you know, but what does that really mean? And I think with an individual in a coaching environment, it's a juicy opportunity to go in and say, you know, where has that shown up? What mm-hmm. are you protecting yourself from? Like there are a lot of ways you can go, but it's a great place to take aim. And as we know, and I think this happens a lot when you're coaching people with neurodivergence, that what you think you're taking aim on is not, or the area of focus of your coaching often shifts as you get into the coaching
mm-hmm.
because what's mm-hmm. really happening is underneath what you thought was happening. And so you have to be willing to stop and take aim again and say, okay, it sounds like what we thought we were talking about that, now we're talking about this. Is this where you want mm-hmm. to focus?
Right.
And that
right.
permission to shift to go deeper and deeper and deeper, I think, is where you, that's what I would say.
That's the dance. That's the dance of coaching and the unpacking and the and I think this is also great, you know, love that you're teaching parents coaching skills so they can, you know, bring this in. And I think what I know, and I know you've raised three children and you and your husband have been coaches for much of that journey. Ursula, two children, same. I have one child, same. And my sense is, they, because of being blessed with parents, I'm not going to say cursed, I'm going to say blessed, with parents who were coaches, it's a blessing. What I have noticed is they do think about challenges in a different way. There is a huge impact in how their brains naturally process things. And so I can really see this. You know, mm-hmm. like I would encourage all parents that have complex children to, you know, go learn from Elaine how to be
thank
more
you.
Coach-like.
Well, I will tell you, there was one summer where David and I, all three of our kids independently, and they were, the youngest was probably 19, and all three of them independently came to us one summer and said, thank you for being coaches, because they all saw the ways in which they were using in their life the skills that they had learned from us. It was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
They may not always say it, but there was that moment.
that makes up for all of the eye rolls where they're like, don't coach me. Elaine, we have to wrap up. We are going to post a link to your website and a link to, I know you've got a resource for coaches. Any, you know, final thoughts, advice that you want to share with the folks listening today?
First of all, I want to say thank you because this was just a delightful conversation and I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed it. Clearly, it's a topic of such profound impact on all of us. I think what I leave with in this moment, what's coming to me in a moment, is I think it's to invite coaches to get comfortable talking about neurodivergence and neurodiversity and neurospiciness without judgment and shame, to get enough information, even if that information is to say, you know, I don't really know a lot about this, but I'm going to learn more, or I want to explore it, or I want to find out more. But to give ourselves permission, you know, we talk in one of our trainings about the difference between coaching therapy and being therapeutic. And, you know, coaching is a really therapeutic modality, but that doesn't mean we're doing therapy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean that we need to understand our community and our people well enough to know when we're the best person to support them and when we need to refer them. And if we're not educated enough, it's hard for us to really be making a conscious, intentional decision about when and when not to refer or when to collaborate with another helping professional.
Yeah, awesome. No, absolutely. Well, I have to say I learned so much. While I'm also not a door taker, but I am a sticky note taker. So I have about five green and yellow sticky notes now with various things that you have said that will really help me moving into my next coaching session, I'm sure. So thank you very much. I appreciate you, Elaine.
This was an absolute delight, and I hope lots of our community goes and checks you out. And thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Yeah,
you
thanks
as well.
Everybody.
Take care,
Yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. You want to know more about Elaine and Be Above Leadership, just go and visit our website, beaboveleadership.com. Thanks very much, Anne, Elaine, And take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.